Hello,
hey,
hello, Matt. How are you doing?
How are you doing? I'm doing good. I'm doing good. How
Excellent.
are you, man? How are you?
I am all right. As I let folks know last week, it's still Sugar Shack season here in Western Massachusetts. The staff is still flowing.
It sounds
so
dirty.
It sounds
so
dirty. Get some grade B. Don't wuss out and get the grade A. Get the hard stuff.
It sounds so dirty. It's like a Def Leppard song or something, though.
No one
Sugar
has sung
Shack,
the quintessential
baby.
Grade B maple syrup song yet. We may need to do that.
Well, it's going to happen eventually. Pour some sugar syrup on somebody, not me. Lots to talk about this week, of course. Let's talk about James O'Keefe and NPR. I've got a lot to say about this.
America's greatest investigative journalist.
Okay, well, let's start with that. This is not journalism. It is activism.
We talked about this 2 weeks ago.
I know. Like before
you
this,
expressed yeah. your dismay that these types of stunts were driving news coverage.
I did, and this is before the NPR thing happened. Now, first of all,
right.
I believe NPR should be defunded, should not receive taxpayer funding. But having said that, a few thoughts about this. I mean, like, so I've given some thought to, like, Why is this not journalism? And I think at the end of the day, it comes down to motive. If your motive, well, first of all, if you, and I know that the institutions have lost, you know, every damn institution, from the institution of marriage to the media institutions have lost, you know, to the Republican Party, to the Vatican has lost power the last few years. But if you work for a media outlet, like if James O'Keefe even worked for the Daily Caller or a new media outlet, that would be a little different. But I think it's the motive. If your goal is to uncover something and report on it, it is a very nuanced thing. I think that's journalism. If your goal is to defund them for political purposes, I think it's activism. Nothing wrong with activism, by the way, in and of itself. I mean, activism is fine, but it's just this insistence on defining this as some sort of activism. And I understand why they do it, and I also think that part of the deal is that the left in the past has probably gotten away with some of this stuff and have been able to hide behind the cloak of journalism. But that's my take, Bill. Where am I wrong?
Well, like I said, on the last time we talked, I think pranks are pranks and journalism is journalism. And when a prank happens, sometimes pranks can be embarrassing to the person who was pranked, but it's the journalist's job to look at the fuller context before writing the story. And in this case, I thought a lot of journalists simply plucked out seemingly sensational aspects of what happened without any kind of stepping back and asking what did it really mean.
I hate to jump in, Bill, but you've triggered a thought as usual, and I did not make my point clearly in the beginning.
Okay.
When I talked about the
go right ahead.
Okay. I think it's a very complex distinction here. When I talked about the motive, a journalist's motive, I think, should be to uncover things that are wrong, to expose them. But when you go into it, if you go into this thinking, I don't think NPR should be receiving subsidies, and therefore I want to expose it, therefore a political end will occur, meaning what's likely to now happen. I think that is activism. If you go into it saying, I'm going to expose this, perhaps this wrong, under the guise of for journalistic purposes. So it's a sort of nuanced distinction. But I think it's the motive. If you go in there thinking, you know, I'm doing this so that NPR will be defunded because I think they should be defunded, I think that by definition is activism. And again, I don't think that's inherently a bad thing, but it ain't journalism. Do you get my point? Am I driving that home?
Oh, I get your point. I mean, I don't totally share it in that I think there is such a thing as opinion journalism, which is different than traditional journalism, but there's a long history of it. But when you do opinion journalism, you're still being journalistic. You are still reporting facts in context, and you're making your own desires, your own agenda transparent, so the reader can draw his or her own conclusions. Now, in this case, this being a prank, I don't. There's a motive here. There's an agenda here. There's a desired goal here. But the journalistic aspect of it is lost on me because there's no attempt to put the comments made in any kind of broader context. They're just put out there raw, hoping folks would.
So you're saying, Bill. So we are differing on this. I'm saying that this is not. It sounds to me like you're saying if James O'Keefe had simply, shown the video and then shown a clip of him standing there with a microphone saying, "Well, folks, now that you've seen what's happening at NPR, we have to ask ourselves." So you're saying that if there had been some sort of narration to it,
a journalist would take the comment, interview some other people,
okay,
at NPR, get their assessments. If the issue we're talking about here is what the NPR vice president of development, which is a fundraiser position, not a journalistic position, if the issue is what he said about the Tea Party, that he says that they're racist, contrast that with what the NPR's coverage of the Tea Party was, which Eric Bollert at Media Matters did, and said, you know what, look at their Tea Party coverage. It's extremely balanced. There's no NPR story that is, let's look at how racist the Tea Party is. Like, that story never was aired. It didn't exist. So is that a real issue at NPR, that they have all this coverage saying the Tea Party is racist? No, it isn't. That would be a journalistic conclusion.
Right. Well, and again, I thought they should have been defunded
before. NPR gets federal funding.
2% of their funding comes from the government, which I think some people is an argument for why they shouldn't be defunded. I think it's they can survive on private donations. They can survive on the free market like everybody else.
But the affiliates can't.
That's the latest argument. But in any event...
That's what the NPR representative said explicitly. That was his comment. The people brought this up to say that he was undercutting NPR's argument about funding. What he said himself was, yeah, we could probably do without the federal funding long term, but short term, our affiliates are going to get hurt because that's not where all of the corporation public broadcasting funding goes. So that's the sticky issue. I think you're right. I think NPR nationally is pretty well funded at this point.
Right.
It has a very broad membership base and has corporate underwriting, and they would be okay. But if there's no individual affiliates to air their programming, that only goes so far.
So the comment that the person made...
In broader context, isn't all that controversial.
But I don't think that's key to our discussion here anyway, in terms of the new media angle to this. I mean, O'Keefe is a new media figure. Now, let me move to a slightly different point here, which is to say, well, two quick things. First, I understand part of the reason I think, and I want to reiterate this point that I made earlier, is I think that a lot of what's happened in the past that has been passed off as journalism was actually activism, mainly coming from the left. But I want to dig in a little bit deeper on something that you just said. So I think you're saying you don't have a problem with the fact that he set up somebody. You don't have a problem with the fact that he pretended or he had somebody pretend to be somebody he wasn't. You don't have a problem with the fact that he taped somebody without their knowledge and or consent, which I think is scummy. You don't have a problem with any of that. You just think you think he just didn't go far enough in trying to like interview more people and actually put it in context. So you don't have a problem with the deceit and all that part of it.
I don't know if I'd quite say I don't have a problem with it. It's certainly not how I go about my own blogging. I'm not interested in misrepresenting myself to do my job. But I think that there are people out there who are going to prank people, who are going to do things that are unethical in the course of having a prank and trying to embarrass somebody. When that happens, it's a journalist's job to not just run with the prank and hold it up and say, ha, 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 someone got embarrassed and humiliated here. It's a journal. If something transpired in the course of the prank that could potentially be newsworthy, it's a journalist's job to actually then do their own reporting and discern if there's actual news there. Anyone who is being a prankster should not be treated as a journalist themselves and have their work be sort of passed along as if it is a journalistic product.
Well, and that's where I think this is interesting. I mean, I think that O'Keefe is a very smart person. And I think that if he were working for a media outlet, that would give him a certain amount of cachet and perhaps some gray hair around, you know, some traditional journalists to balance, not to undermine his enthusiasm or excitement, which sometimes unfortunately happens, but to provide a little counsel, like, hey, let's not lure, you know, female reporters onto boats. And to provide a little bit, like, I know I've benefited from having people edit me and say, why don't you make one more phone call before you file that? So I think he could have benefited from a little bit of structure and working in a, I'm not saying traditional like the Washington Post, but, you know, Daily Call or whatever, having some other mentors, older folks around. And then the other idea, too, would be comedy. We need, the right needs a Jon Stewart. Jon Stewart is incredibly smart, and he does really brilliant stuff. And I feel like when you set yourself up as a journalist and you try to say, no, I'm a journalist, that's really setting yourself up for scrutiny, which is only fair. But if you say, hey, this is comedy, we're just pointing out hypocrisy on the left. This is comedy. Don't you think there's
your
a way?
Hope is that James O'Keefe will turn what he does into a cable TV comedy show.
Don't you think? Well, you're joking. I mean, don't you think that this exact footage?
No, I'm not totally joking.
Don't you think
what you're saying?
This footage that he has, I think, could have been just as effective. Could have been done humorously, and wouldn't have had the backlash that he's encountered. Am I wrong about that?
I think it's a very astute point. I mean, what The Daily Show does, I mean, we don't always know exactly how their pieces come about, to what extent their subjects are aware what The Daily Show is trying to do, or they're unaware and the editing is just done to humiliate
right.
them. Unbeknownst
but if
to
you
them.
Ever criticize them, they say, oh, hey, we're just a comedy show, man. What do you expect? And yet they get stuff done, including funding for 9/11 rescuers.
Well, I mean, The Daily Show does, I mean, they do blur the lines to some degree. I mean, Jon Stewart has an interview section, which is generally not comedy, or sometimes is not comedy, where Stewart is asking serious questions. And I think it's not accurate to then slough off.
Oh, but he does it, and he gets away with it, because it's a great, whatever, if anybody criticizes him, he can always say, we're a comedy show, man! And he does
I think there are times where he has done that where I think that has been a bit of a cop-out excuse because they're talking about something that really inherently isn't comedy. But some of the tape segments, which are essentially, you know, elaborate pranks, you know, they generally are treated as comedy and don't get criticized for it.
Right.
But most of the time that stuff tends not to have broader political impact. You know, what happened with the 9/11 bill was they had a very long segment of the show which was not comedic at all, which was pretty much interviews with 9/11 first responders. I think there was a set piece where they mocked a lot of people that were holding up the legislation. That sort of falls closer to the satire line where there's clearly an agenda involved than simply a comedy line. So I think that was a situation where the show wasn't being primarily a comedic show and had an impact. When they are being primarily a comedy show and are pranking folks, people laugh about it. It may shape people's perceptions about things among folks that already have
those
perceptions.
Let me say this. I think this isn't just O'Keefe. This is other Republican politicians that I see. They have somewhat of a complex that the media is out to get them, and that makes them do things and and appear to be hostile in a way that isn't necessary. I believe that this, that a lot of the good that they do could be done with a lot less backlash and gnashing of teeth if they did it a little bit differently. That's just my personal
opinion. But it seems like O'Keefe is getting zero backlash for this. I mean, he got a lot of backlash for the CNN caper.
Well, part of that's because NPR are wussies. Let me tell you, if I ran NPR...
Yes!
If I ran NPR...
We agree on that.
I would have gone to... First of all, if I ran... The minute this story broke, I would have gone on the offense. I would have talked about O'Keefe's caper down in Louisiana. I would have, you know, I don't know what it was, a misdemeanor, but whatever. I would have talked about the attempt to lure a reporter from CNN onto a boat. And I would have said, we are not going to let a single person go until I see the full unedited tape. And how dare you take this person's word, who has a questionable background, over a professional NPR employee. I'm going to stand by my people. And let's see the full unedited tape, and then we will make an announcement. But only after we see the tape, because guess what? There are other instances of people showing only partial excerpts of tapes that are wildly taken out of context. I'm going to stand by my people. You got to go on the offense. These are panty waists out there. I can't believe how they folded like a cheap suit. It's unbelievable.
You'd make such a good liberal, Matt.
No, it's look, this is how politics are done. You're tough, and you stand by your people. And, you know, usually the left is a lot tougher than this. You probably disagree with me, but you know what? Do you think James Carville would have, if he were running NPR, what would he have done?
I'm sure it would be very different. NPR, I think Jonathan Chait in the New Republic pointed this out, that any conservative that thinks that this is going to lead to NPR being defunded is kidding themselves. That's never going to happen. Certainly not in any time in the foreseeable future. They have a huge base of support. I mean, this is the biggest media operation in the country. I believe even Matt Lewis is a faithful listener.
And by the way, let me just say, as a conservative, I like a lot of the NPR programming. Look, I go into it knowing that they're liberally biased. I know that. I know that Bruce Springsteen's a leftist. I still like his music. I mean, I go into it knowing that. I just don't want my taxpayer dollars funding them.
But I'm not trying to impugn your conservative monopoly, sir.
You know,
I'm only pointing out that NPR has a huge base of intrinsic support.
But I'm saying that they've got some of their programming
tens of millions
really
of faithful
good.
Listeners, yeah. And there's no way their funding's going to get pulled. So Chait pointed out that what is a more likely impact of this is that NPR gets more cowed and bends over backwards even more to ensure they have conservative voices represented on their airwaves, which they've already done to a large extent ever since the 90s when Newt Gingrich was threatening their funding. And so you might see a change in their coverage because of the sort of working the refs tactic, but you're not going to see a defunding.
And that's a great, you know
and
what?
That speaks and to their general wimpy nature in the boardroom.
And if that happens, then the activism will have been effective, and kudos to conservatives for doing that.
Well, that's right, and that's why they go. O'Keefe is getting no backlash here. He's got backlash in other instances.
But he's
the backlash on his Acorn stuff happened belatedly after the damage to Acorn was done. The CNN thing, he suffered the. And he, I mean, obviously, he was prosecuted in Louisiana and convicted, right? At least a plea bargain, but he had a felony put on, if I recall.
I don't know the detail. I don't want to, like, you know.
I'm sure someone on the internets can correct me. I believe he was ended up with a felony conviction. And there was a CNN thing that blew up in his face. But despite that background, because NPR did fold,
right,
he is being lauded as the giant killer without any backlash whatsoever.
And they folded like a cheap suit, and they should have fought tooth and nail for their people, and they should have gone to war against James O'Keefe. That's smart politics. That's what if I were running NPR, I would have gone to war with him and brought up every little past indiscretion. I mean, this is what I would have done. I mean,
well, in some defense of NPR here, I mean, they have a reputation of being, I understand conservatives don't see this as NPR, but amongst everyone else, they have a reputation of being an impartial news source.
And what about standing up? What about standing by your employees?
That. So if they're going to act in a more political manner, they might worry that their funding would then be jeopardized.
They could.
So they have to be very careful
with
that.
But I think they could have I think they would have been well advised and perfectly within bounds to say, and then I'm going to quit giving advice to the left, but to say...
NPR is not the left, sir.
To say, we, as a policy, stand by our employees. The video excerpts that you've shown me are troubling. We want to see the full video. If you show, you know, and until that time, we are going to stand by our employees because that's our policy. I mean, how do you engender loyalty and motivate people when you throw them under the bus? Look, this guy could be guilty as sin, but someone, I don't know where I heard it, I think it was Dave Weigel today tweeted out, and again, this is hearsay, but I believe Dave Weigel tweeted out that in a different part of the tape, the guy says something to the effect of, yeah, I'm a lifelong Republican, and my parents were, I mean, that didn't make it into the tape. Does it matter? Right. I don't know. But maybe he said something else. But
none of this should matter. He's not even a journalist. look at the coverage.
The other thing too is, then we should probably move on. We could talk about this all day. But you know, this is fine. If this is what somebody wants their career to be about, that's fine. I mean, though, I could write a book called The Green Room. Every time I go to CNN or MSNBC, I could bring a tape recorder. And I could tape everything that's said, and there are things said by conservatives and liberals who assume that it's off the record because you'd have to be kind of a dick to do what I'm saying that I could do, which is to tape people without their knowledge and or consent who assume that they're speaking off the record. And they make jokes and they say things that guys and gals sometimes say, sometimes over a beer. I mean, I could do that, and I could, you know, come out with some tell-all book that I'm not even going to name names because I don't want anybody to think that I would do this. But so-and-so said this or joked about that. I could do that.
And I would buy that book.
You would. A lot of people would buy the book, but what kind of person would I be to do that?
I feel very bad about buying it.
I don't want my career to be about that. And anyway.
I think James O'Keefe has a different view of his career than you do.
Maybe. I don't know. But I thought it was wrong.
I think he's pretty happy where his career has gone.
I thought it was scummy when they did that bogus call to Governor Walker. And so, consistency's sake. All right, let's talk about AOL. You want to why don't you start off here?
Well,
since I'm already worked up.
As everyone knows, Matt Lewis defiantly quit AOL's Politics Daily, saying he would not work under the fascist dictatorship of Arianna Huffington. And join the Daily Caller.
Fight the power.
Now his jumping of the ship seems very prescient because AOL announced a 1,000 person layoff today, 20% of their staff, including one of your former colleagues there. Correct?
Not just colleague, but Melinda Henneberger, who basically ran the show. She was the visionary behind Politics Daily, a great journalist. And she was laid off today. On Monday, my editor, Carl Cannon, son of famed Reagan biographer Lou Cannon, started his new job at Real Clear Politics. And without those two, it's not going to be Politics Day. I don't care what they call it, but it's not going to be
Politics. Well, I'm assuming that they're decimating it and folding it into Huffington Post. And Melinda, I believe she used to be one of the top editors at Huffington Post. So it's like Huffington is going out of their way to destroy her career.
Well, I think Melinda was only there briefly, and perhaps briefly for a reason. The other irony, of course, is that Arianna Huffington's book called Third World America, Bill, and I can't help but think that some of the journalists that work at AOL might be picking up a copy of Third World America to see what their future might be, as they're on the unemployed line, and what is it, the 99 Club? What's this thing? After
the 99ers are the folks who have been unemployed for more than 99 weeks have their unemployment benefits cut off under the current law, even though the jobs crisis continues. And coverage of that beat has been one of the Huffington Post staples, whether it's the 99ers or folks who have been caught up in the housing crisis. And that was the basis of Arianna's Third World America book. So it's certainly, I'm sure, discomforting for some of the folks there to now be not just associated with, but directly the cause of, you know, a very large layoff. And I don't know. This just happened today, so I haven't seen any blogosphere takes on it yet. I mean, I would imagine the right will easily cackle about this. I don't know if folks on the left are going to take shots at Huffington Post for hypocrisy here, or folks are going to still look at Huffington Post as still generally a good source of that sort of coverage, and therefore.
I'm glad I got out while I did. Here's another interesting thing. Jonathan Dube, I don't know how it's pronounced, D-U-B-E, he tweets at Cyber Journalist, and he's a big muckety-muck at AOL. And he tweeted out, "I have just laid off dozens of the most talented journalists and product folks I know. Need talent? Let me know."
Is the Cyber Journalist part of the AOL empire?
Yeah, it's my understanding. I probably shouldn't talk more about it until I know more about who he is, but I think he's a big like VP or some sort of muckety-muck. Well, let me pull it up here and see if I can find out. But I just found that to be odd. You know, at Politics Daily, we were certainly part of the AOL team, but I mean, like, my exposure to some of the higher-ups was like, limited, which is quite fine with me. But I don't know. It's just a sad thing, you know, and Melinda Henneberger, you know, a terrific journalist in her own right. And Politics Daily was really very much her vision. And what you saw were a lot of really good journalists, people like Walter Shapiro, for example, who had been traditional journalists in the past, you know, working at places like Time or the New York Times, the Washington Post, whatever, coming together, writing thoughtful pieces online. I actually loved my time at Politics Daily. Really liked it there, but very happy that I moved on to the Daily Caller, which I actually start blogging there on Monday officially. But it's just a sad story. I mean, I'm guessing that some of the people that I know who are great writers of Politics Daily, rumor is that some of them are going to keep their job if they want it. Some of them will probably be leaving. But yeah, I mean, Wired has a piece up. I mean, you said 1,000. They're saying 900 jobs, cutting as many as 900. CEO Tim Armstrong announced Thursday, including as many as 200 editorial staffers in the U.S. And Fishbowl DC has a piece specifically about Melinda being laid off. Update. No, this is a we're hearing thing. But update, we're hearing that Walter Shapiro, I just mentioned him. He wrote a great piece, by the way, just the other day about the name's escaping me. The David Broder, who died, the great Washington Post reporter. And columnist. Walter Shapiro wrote a great piece the other day about him. Word is, according to Media Bistro's Fishbowl DC, that he's out on Patricia Murphy, also a very good writer.
I'm sorry to cut you off there, but in talking about this, it occurs to me that there's been a lot of talk before this about a lot of folks in traditional media jumping to new media outlets. Howard Fineman going to Huffington Post, Howard Kurtz going to the Daily Beast, and talking about all this online media as the great frontier. And you know, this type of business decision shows that it's not infinite. There's not unlimited places for people to earn a living in new media. While they may be certainly encroaching on the profitability of old media to a degree, there's not going to be a landing place for everybody. And you know, part of how new media operates is that it presumably can function a lot more cheaply than the way more traditional media operations have run, and that doesn't necessarily lead to more and more jobs. So,
since you mentioned other people moving on, I mean, we talked about it the other week, Mickey Kaus going to the Daily Caller. we know that Andrew Sullivan, as I believe, is leaving the Atlantic and going to the Daily Beast. Michael Calderon.
Well, Sullivan's a more interesting situation.
Let's talk about that for a second.
Yeah.
Well, let me just quickly go through a couple others. Michael Calderon leaving Yahoo to go to AOL, HuffPost, and John Ward, who left the Daily Caller to have a cup of coffee at the Daily, now going to AOL, HuffPost. So, but tell me about let's talk about Andrew Sullivan. Because he's sort of like
a lot of what you just mentioned is a lot of sort of musical chairs within online media, which speaks to how little, you know, there are few long-standing career. There's few David Broders are going to be at one place for, you know, 40 years of their career in the online world. People seem to get ahead by jumping around as fast as possible, and have people talk about their career moves. But Sullivan is a unique case, and I'm not saying this as a Sullivan fan because I'm really not one. But he apparently has 1 million plus unique visitors of his own, and they follow him. And this is probably more true of him than maybe anybody else in the online media world. And so, you know, he started one of the first political blogs.
Right.
Although unlike what we consider bloggers, he was an established media personality first before he started an online operation. Nevertheless, he started it back in, I think in 2000. And built that presence up on his own, folded it into, I think Time Magazine, and then The Atlantic, and both these magazines, old media. So he has always been walking this line between old and new in his work, although I think in later years he's been more identified with his new media product than his old media product, because he is prolific. I should say he and his team are prolific, because he does not do his blog by himself. But he's developed a great loyalty to the point where he can go wherever he wants.
Right.
Well, with assurance that his audience is going to go with him.
And that's vital. Let me jump in there, Bill, because you know, I've talked about before my, you know, I think I've talked about this before, how I used to play in bands, you know, before I got into politics. I play a little music. And there's a lot of analogies to it. And one of the things, when I first started playing in bands, I thought the key was you get booked at a really good club or a really good bar, and then you've made it. But what I learned is that used to be true during the height of the original music scene where I'm from in Maryland. But those days had passed, and so the key to getting booked at a good bar wasn't that you were a good band. It was that you could bring a crowd who would buy beer and make money for the bar. So, in other words, the goal as a band wasn't to become really good at music exclusively. It was to develop a following that would come with you to whatever bar you went to, and sort of supplement the crowd there. And it's the same exact model that we see with Sullivan. I mean, Sullivan, he was in on the ground floor in a way. So like, I can't compete with that, but I have to use things like Twitter and Facebook and other ways to drive traffic. But like when I go to the Daily Caller, it's not like if you build it, they will come. I'm not going to assume, oh, I'm at the Daily Caller now. People are going to go to the Daily Caller, and they're going to see. By the way, a quick aside: the top story at the Daily Caller now is a new video from a new video. NPR was going to accept Muslim Education Action Center donation and hide it from the government. So apparently, another shoe is about to drop from the O'Keefe video. Stay tuned. But back to my original story, I don't expect just because I'm blogging at the Daily Caller or Politics Daily or wherever, if you're a blogger nowadays, you're just like I was when I was a musician. You've got to put butts in the seats. It's not enough to be good at what you do. You have to bring the audience with you. That is the new world that we live in.
Right, and so I think there are very few people who have been able to show that they have their own identifiable followings that will follow them. And so for Sullivan, so basically here you have this Daily Beast Newsweek hybrid, which has been widely mocked as sort of an ungainly coupling between old and new media. And a lot of skepticism that's going to work. Not a lot of raves about the new redesign that Tina Brown, the editor, launched this past week. But she can have some assurance that when Andrew Sullivan comes over in the spring, that there's going to be a built-in, you know, chunk of people going to that website because he's there. And so it's a huge blow to the Atlantic. I think he was very singular, not the only reason why, but pretty singular in why the Atlantic had able to do a transition from being just a magazine to a pretty robust online presence. And now they're going to have to see if they can survive without him and survive without those million-plus people. But it puts Andrew really in a driver's seat that he can sort of go wherever he wants.
And you can negotiate your deal and all that stuff.
Right, so it's very low risk. I mean, let's say you know, Daily Beast Newsweek merger tanks. I don't think that's going to sully him. He'll just go do the next thing because people
but
like.
See, that's my advice to any
that likes what he does.
To any young blogger out there. You know, this goes to, like, everything happening in our world, Bill. The day of working at any company for 40 years, whether you're, you know, David Broder at the Washington Post or Joe Schmo working at IBM or whatever, you know, you don't get that gold watch after 50 years anymore. They could cut you. I was at Politics Daily. Melinda liked me. Carl liked me. I think I did a good job for them. And I would have probably been fired today. Had I still been there, because there's so many things outside your control, and it's not enough for your boss and even your boss's boss to like you. The company could shut down, it could get bought out. Arianna Huffington could come to work at your company. You could be screwed. So you have to basically, you can't rely on the company alone. You also have to build a brand. You have to own your own Twitter feed. Don't have the company Twitter feed. Develop your contacts. It doesn't mean that you're not loyal to your company. But you have to build your own brand. If your company has a publicist and that publicist controls all of your TV booking, when you're fired, you won't have a relationship with TV producers and you won't get back on TV, at least not for a while. So all these things, it's free agent nation, as Dan Pink would have called it. It's you sort of run your own show now. And Andrew Sullivan... I would call him a lefty, but he certainly has an entrepreneurial spirit, and he's engaged in the free market, and he's winning. So kudos to him.
But I also don't think, I mean, in one sense, I think you're absolutely right. In another sense, very few people are going to pull it off. There's only so many ways you can, you know, provide, you know, unique takes on what's going on in the news. To a point where people are going to look at you as being essential to their understanding of things. It's so easy to cast, you know, punditry on and off. And, you know, just speaking
of myself.
How are we doing it, Bill?
We're doing it. We're living the dream.
I mean,
you've got Adonis
blood
in your DNA.
So I'm in sort of a unique situation where a nonprofit activist organization pays me a regular, you know, full time salary. That's also an arrangement that few will be able to pull off.
We both got babies at home now, Bill. We've got.
I understand. I understand fully. But when I wasn't blogging at liberaloasis.com regularly and I shipped a lot of my blogging over to ourfuture.org, a lot of people that were friends of mine, I know, did not simply just start picking up where I left off and read me on the other side. Like, where are you again?
Yeah.
Oh, you're over there? It's like they have to go cross town to find you now. They don't know how to get there.
I mean, and these are people who are on the internet. It's not 1987. It is unbelievable. How
Maybe
people
I
who
type
are otherwise
something different and put you in the RSS feed. I gotta put something else in my bookmarks. I don't know how that works.
And people who are like otherwise competent in their life, it's like the hardest thing in the world for them to. I've had the exact same phenomenon, same experience. But
so it's hard to get in the capper seat that Andrew Sullivan is in. And if I knew exactly how he did it, I'd be doing it myself, and I haven't. So I don't want to pretend I know more about this than I do.
I mean, he's one, you know, I think part of it is he was at the right place at the right time. I mean, a lot of this is, look, if I was playing in Maryland, where I'm from, in the 1980s, I wouldn't have had to have built a crowd. I could have just shown up at, you know, Tully's in Frederick, Maryland and expected, you know, 1,000 fans there. But in 1995, things were a little different, you know. So same thing.
Well, yeah, he had some first mover advantage being right. one of the first to do this sort of thing, but you know, that only gets you so far. I mean, he has maintained, steady stream of posts, a willingness to, shift ideologically, without being seen by at least his fans as
somebody
being
pointed
unprincipled
out,
in doing so.
Somebody pointed out the other day, and I don't know if this is true, but it was somebody smart, maybe Jim Garrity, I don't know, but pointed out the other day that he has never supported the same presidential candidate two elections in a row, which is something considering how long he's been around. So
no, I mean there is a very small world of professional contrarians, and it's a hard game. It's hard tightrope to walk again without seeing like you're just doing it for gimmickry.
But you know who Christopher Hitchens, I think, is sincere in his contrarianism.
I mean,
I think he is legitimately.
Some people think so, and some people don't.
Legitimately,
some people don't. But they both have people buy their books and
he is legitimately
and scribbling,
the
so
ass,
they're doing something right
with no gimmickry and no self promotion. I think he is legitimately a curmudgeon. Some people would call me a contrarian. Others would call me a Republican Party hack. But I think certainly my piece on John Boehner's alcoholism. The allegations surrounding that might disprove that, but I like the contrarian thing. But you know, there's a lot of gimmickry involved in being at the top of the business and the top of punditry, and you always have to be controversial. And so I try to be controversial about things that I actually believe are true as much as possible. So. Anyway, do you want to talk Wisconsin, or should do you want to move quickly here? What do you want to do?
Let's skip that for now. I got a baby to feed.
Okay.
But I do want to talk about what's happening with Michelle Malkin's cousin.
Yeah,
who is missing.
Serious.
And Michelle has used her website to try to locate her, and maybe you can talk more detail about that.
Her name is Marizela Perez. She is still missing. She disappeared from the Seattle area. And if you go to michellemalkin.com, you can see a picture of her. She's been missing now for about a week. There's a police report filed that will tell you about her. Asian female, 5'5" tall. Who knows what happened? I'm looking through a really cute picture here. Of Michelle Malkin, who's a former classmate of yours, Bill, of her with her cousin when this young lady was actually a little girl, and Michelle was pregnant. Check it out at michellemalkin.com. But you know, I mean, whether you like Michelle Malkin or not, I think you gotta be pulling for her here on this hopefully not a tragedy, but. You know, she's been missing now for about a week. So I think our thoughts and prayers ought to be with her. And folks in the Seattle area, definitely check out michellemalkin.com and see what you can do to help.
And I would imagine there are probably a lot of folks in Seattle who are not regular readers of Michelle Malkin, but certainly want to see anyone missing be found. So even if you're not of a conservative persuasion, it would be a good time if you're in the Seattle area to check out her site and see if you've seen her cousin around.
Last thing I want to say, Bill, before I close out, at least, is there's a website, glennlasbury.wordpress.com, and it's called Ramblings, and he has a really good profile on Kubachi, whom I've talked about on this show before. Her real name is Jennifer Caballero. On Twitter, she's at CUBACHI. And there's 10 questions for her, and it's a fascinating read about this young lady who's really part of, I think, a growing phenomenon of women who have become very influential without being traditional journalists or traditional activists. Although I think Jennifer actually does some work in the news media industry. Primarily, what we know of her is because of the advent of Twitter, and she's great on Twitter. She is definitely an opinion leader, and I would recommend checking out this column about her.
I think there are more sort of growing conservative online stars that have sprung up from Twitter.
Yeah.
I think
and a lot
more
of
so
women.
Than on the left. Not that there aren't folks left that could potentially be. I just don't think that I haven't seen liberal bloggers sort of cast about to find them and share with their audiences that these folks are out there, even though
Melissa Clouthier is another prime example. At Melissa Tweets on Twitter, she's filled in on this show before. Without Twitter, I don't think most people would know who she is. I mean, she has a blog, she's a good writer, she has a podcast that's good, but I think it was Twitter that actually was sort of propelled her into the punditry, the punditsphere, whatever you want to call
it. Right. I agree.
So, good show, man. Well, hopefully things work out in Seattle, and hopefully things work out for my colleagues at AOL, at Politics Daily. So a little bit of a sad show in some ways, but, take them as we get them.
There's always sadness in the world. All we can try to do is help make it a little bit better.
That's right, and that's what we do week in and week out here, Bill.
Or something approximately.
Or every 2 weeks for me. And by the way, we should probably bring this up. I don't even really address this. So I was here full time, and then I was going to leave, and I couldn't.
Yeah, you're still here.
I couldn't quit you, and so we got my agent on the phone, and we worked out a lucrative deal whereby I'm on every other week, which allows me to spend some time in my other affairs, but still, come and anger the commenters on this show at least a couple times a month. So happy to be here, and I'm now a occasional co-host, or one of the co-hosts, I guess.
And we're happy to have you.
Well, always fun talking with you, Bill. And anything you need to plug or sell, any product
placement? Well, just today, Campaign for America's Future wrapped up the summit on jobs in America's future at ourfuture.org/jobsummit. Richard Trumka had some choice words for Governor Scott Walker there. Van Jones had a very inspirational closing out speech. So I don't believe it was streamed, but there will probably be video clips and other highlights and coverage of it on ourfuture.org over the course of the next few days.
Awesome. All right, Bill. Good seeing you, and mahalo. Is that how I pronounce it?
Take care.
All right. See you.